Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the 10th Digital Plasticist Work in Progress Seminar. For those of you who haven't been before, the Digital Plasticist Seminars are designed as a forum for both students and established researchers who are involved in the application of the digital humanities to the study of the ancient world. This summer series is specifically focused on the interdisciplinary and collaborative work at the interface of classics and archaeology and computer science. You should find on the tables the programme for the rest of the seminar series, and I'd like to take this opportunity to advertise next week's seminar, which you should also find on the tables, Ioannis Doukas towards a digital publication for the Homeric Catalogue of Ships. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our speaker, Charlotte Roucher, who's a pioneer of digital epigraphy and professor of classical and Byzantine Greek at King's College London. And she's going to speak to us today on the subject, From Stone to Byte, Implications of the XML Publication of Inscriptions.
Thank you. That's sort of challenging. You give yourself when you don't know quite what you're going to talk about. Comes absolutely everything. I work here. You heard quite a bit about some of the projects I've been involved in when Charlotte spoke, and we are a team. And my job in the team is to write grant applications and explain what we're doing, or excuse what we're doing, perhaps it sometimes feels like. And which is quite nice, because it does require me to kind of stand back and think about things. And since we're into continuity, one kind of continuity between something, some things I'm talking about is with what Charlotte talked about, but I thought it would be elegant to follow directly on from Juan. Juan is somebody who was on our team, but is part of our infiltration of the entire world, our general infiltration program. I'm sure that, like many of you who were here last week, you went away with these images very strongly in your head. They are very powerful images. What I thought is it that is strange about this text? What is the oddest thing about it? What is the most... one's so busy seeing it as an object. But what problems does it present as an object? What would it be like if this was put in front of you? And what's it not got? What it is very, very lacking in markup. It's astonishingly low on indications of where you are. There's just all these words. This is an example. There are some breaks. We've got some... that would happen, wouldn't it? It's very exciting, this mouse. We've got some breaks there. And we've got some indications of the ordering of the text. But actually, trying to find your way in something like this is pretty demanding. And it's, I think one thing is that because one sees the scripta continua, because you see the unbroken flow of words, that is so remarkable to our eye that we tend to stop and think about that. But actually, it's not just the unbroken flow of words without gaps between them that's odd. In terms of making this a usable piece of writing. And we have writing delivered to us now in the most astonishingly facilitated way. And after all, a lot of what you're doing, the transcriptions and things, is facilitating, is making up for the work that isn't there. And why this stuck with me is that because I have to go around as sort of front person for a lot of the things that we're doing, a lot of the rhetoric that we use is to say to the unconverted, of course, none of whom are here, but to the great classical public, that what we are doing is very much in the tradition of what scholars have regularly done. And I think that already came up when Charlotte was speaking, and she talked about our relationship to the Panchira markup schemes. We live, most of the text that we have that's lying around is all marked up in all sorts of different kinds of ways. All these hierarchical presentations of words, and we are trained to know what matters and to know which level of the writing we want to look at, what kind of information will be delivered at what level. So that was came into my mind very much when we were last week. And since then, I've been thinking about it quite a lot. And of course, the unmarked, I have no difficulty with texts that are in, if you'd just like to do that for me, I have no difficulty with texts that are in scripta continua. Inscriptions are quite unhelpful in the way they're presented. They tend to just be a great row of capital letters, rather like that codex. My job, and I'll be coming back to this image later, that's how we prefer to see presented what was on that stone. We have our conventions. That is probably how we don't prefer to see it. But that is the process that produces you the online version. And I shall come back to some of the issues involved in that in a bit. But I go around, I give talks to people who've never seen a marked up text, and I show them this screenshot. And I do feel myself losing the sympathy of the audience at that point. You can see them all saying, well, it's all very well, but if this is what I've got to do, actually, I think I'll continue with my typewriting. It's the moment when you lose them. And that's why one of the things I find I've been thinking about is where what the processes are that have brought us from the unrelieved text of Codex Sinaiticus to where we are now in terms of the way texts are presented to us. The earlier texts are pretty unhelpful. I mean, that's unhelpful for more than one reason. I found, actually, some other examples which are rather better. I couldn't get these into my PowerPoint for whatever reason. This, for example, is a good example of an earlier text, a third century text. Again, it isn't helping you. There is not much there in the way of supports for finding your way through it. There's very little guidance compared to what we're used to. And so one of the things that I've been doing is pursuing what I should have known, what probably lots of you already do know, which is the history of that markup which we rather take for granted. And ancient texts, there are various kinds of ways that you can mark a text up. While this Hebrew Bible is itself 10th century, it's using a method, one of the simplest things, in a way we saw it in Sinaiticus, which is leaving spaces. Start a new line. How often has one said that to students when they give you a draft of a piece of work? Start a new line. Put in a heading. A very, very simple way of indicating changes in the text, which doesn't involve importation of anything, and is therefore appropriate in particular to a sacred text where there may be, it may be felt that it's not appropriate to add even so much as a number. So there, though this is clearly a text where all kinds of additional material has been applied. But that's one of the ways that text got divided up. But of course, you've also got to decide what your division is going to be. And while divisions into, we take the concept of chapter and verse so much for granted. But when you look at the early manuscripts around the 4th and 5th and 6th century, you see that people were dividing texts up. I mean, there were several systems for dividing up the biblical text. The books of the Bible are more or less okay, but within those books, there's not a consistent system. There are lots of different systems in circulation for how you divide the Bible up. One of the things that keeps on recurring is that you divide the text up into pericope, into logical chunks that make sense to you. And from that flows something which happens quite early on in the Bible, certainly by the 4th century, which is the development, dividing it up into passages which you are going to read within the service. And before you know it, scribes will be writing out lectionaries which are made up solely of those sections. And of course, that's entirely rational. So one of the determining factors in the early stages of marking up manuscripts is the marking up for reading aloud. And a related aspect is what Jerome, who undertook a lot of textual work, of course, in producing his great translations in the late 4th century, refers to as cola and commata, where you put full stops and commas. Even if you're not punctuating, you're leaving a space or indicating in some way that there is a moment to draw breath. Again, when explaining to students why punctuation matters, which isn't something that is always apparent to everyone, one of the best ways to get your punctuation right is to work out when you would draw breath. So a lot of these punctuation marking up procedures evolve around the spoken aloud text, the read aloud text. They also develop around the study of the text. And so you have these manuscripts, this wonderful development, again in the 4th century. Though when one says in the 4th century, you always have to remember is that the 4th century is when a lot of stuff within Christian writing surfaces. It may have been going on before, it's just that you don't know about it. But the great canon tables, which are systems constructed to help you compare comparable and parallel passages in the different Gospels. Now that requires you to be able to, if you're going to say, John chapter 4 is the same as, unlikely this, Luke chapter 10. And you haven't got numbered chapters, let alone numbered verses. That becomes quite a complicated thing to say. So you have these tables with wonderful columns, 10 columns in a full canon table, of all the different combinations, showing you all the different combinations, and then with kind of codes where you could go and you could put a code mark in the margin of the manuscript that you're copying. But it's an interesting fact that that people did without the sort of numbering that we take so much for granted for so long. And yet, people were busy using their books, actually even before we look at this Langton. I think another interesting thing to think about is that many books where, I just would go, want to go back and show you another image, which is very pleasing. We all know, I hope, the great big initial B of Beatus Vir. Why is that a famous line? Because it's the first line of the first psalm. Interestingly, even when people do start numbering things in the Old Testament and the New, they're quite slow to number the psalms because we all know them by heart. We can all recognize the first line. And traditionally, the psalms are referred to simply by citing their first line. And that's quite a reflects an astonishing attitude of memory. I've had a nice time investigating all of this, and I discovered, much to my surprise, that the first agreed numbering of chapters of the Old Testament is Stephen Langton, who to us is famous for involvement in Magna Carta, who ended up as Archbishop of Canterbury. But as with other Archbishops of Canterbury, started as a university lecturer in Paris. And I was rather attracted, and the point of this very early manuscript is to show the coloured capital letters of the new caput of the new chapter. Why did Stephen Langton and his friends, why at this moment does a standardised system, which is certainly credited to him in the sources, then become standard? Because people are starting to use the texts in a different kind of way. Because this is emerging in a university environment. As one of the rather charming texts I was reading suggested, because the students didn't know the Bible as well as everybody else did, or couldn't be relied upon to remember things quite so well. But in a way, what I think is interesting about this, and really quite important, is that standardization of reference, which in some ways is a very mundane and very boring thing, is the absolute prerequisite of shared discussion. Those earlier texts that we're seeing are either for you to read aloud to the congregation, or they're for you to study on your own, or perhaps with a few students around you who take notes and write those commentary notes that we know so well from ancient manuscripts, where you simply, the student's copy, which survives to us, has just the lemma, just the citation of the words, and then the commentary about that lemma. But the minute you've all agreed that chapter 12 is chapter 12, an intellectual liberation takes place. You're free to be able to discuss things in many more people can discuss and communicate with one another in a really realistic way. And therefore, I mean, we know which text we'd rather have. I think we'd definitely rather have Juan's Codex than this mess. which really is looks like, you know, those books at school that have been that handed out to children at the beginning of the year and returned at the end of the year. And each year they get another layer of people writing it. At least they haven't invented magic marker at this point. But it's less than totally tidy, but that is really about study. I mean, that is real interaction with the text, isn't it, in a rather extreme way. So, I was, personally, I didn't know that chapter, that the agreed chapters, as opposed to concept of chapters, and the concept of sections, was quite so late. And I do think it's yet another thing which makes the 13th century interesting. And of course, then printing is going to come to us. And I had to show you some Aldine editions, just because of the pleasure of thinking about Aldine editions. Also, just to remind you that from antiquity, people have been dividing their texts up on the large scale. Herodotus's wonderful naming of his books by the Muses, that's very elegant. It's still not very useful for finding things. Aldus and the printing press are the next step in this process of dissemination, of extending the market. And therefore, if it's necessary for the students at the University of Paris to be able to refer to the same, to know they're all referring to the same thing. When you suddenly increase the quantity of users in this kind of way, the need for such communication becomes much greater. And it's this man, Stephanus, to be distinguished from his son, Henri Etienne, also called Stephanus, I mean, that is really helpful, who is the person who introduces chapters, who introduces verses to the Bible. And there's a huge literature all about it, like, was he on a horse at the time? I mean, really wonderful kind of footnotes about this kind of thing. But he introduces verses into the fourth edition of the Greek Bible that he produces. Not the first, not the third, second, not the third, but in the fourth, in 1551, he has this idea, and he further annotates the text he'd already got with verses. It's a Greek-Latin Bible. How useful to have the verse numbers, since you might be better at one of the languages than the other. So you're going to be able to follow your way through. And I think it's extremely interesting that it's Etienne's son, Henri, who does something very similar for the newly emerging publications of ancient texts. Because whenever we read Plato, and we read those random, but to us just handed down from God, numbers, we all know that you talk about Apology 453a. Never does it occur to us to question that one should do so. But those references are to Henri Etienne's pagination. And those references have been carried over into editions of Plato ever since, and making it possible for us, well, completely transforming one's ability to talk about these texts. And the really prudent thing is that nobody ever changed it. They've stuck with these A, B, C, and D, even on pages where they make absolutely no sense at all. They roll along, but that's where it's all come from these early printed editions. So it's a crucial moment. Now, here is a man, not they're very nice, these photographs, aren't they? Here, of course, we're very, very happy to see Burke, the father of Greek inscriptions. But I'm actually thinking about Becker. He's the man whose numbering in the early 19th century of his edition of Aristotle produced the first agreed numbers for Aristotle. Now, that's quite surprising when you think for how long Aristotle had been in circulation in the West. And there are, what I haven't looked into is exactly what St. Thomas Aquinas used. But those that number is going to be the number that gives you your Becker. Now, you might think that the rationality of this was absolutely obvious to all. But I may say this is the 11th century text which I'm interested in, which has been published three times. The Greek text has been published three times with no carried over and consistent system of numbering. Their life was complicated by the fact that a late scribe added chapter headings and numbers. The only problem about those is that they're clearly added and make no sense. So there's one of those chapter headings inserted within the text. The text rolls along. This gar makes it clear that that is part of the passage that precedes. But the number has got inserted in absolutely the wrong place. So they're no use to you. But it's an interesting aspect of, particularly in Byzantine studies, that people have been very, very lazy about marking up texts. Now, you may say, you may possibly have difficulty with the logical transition here. The last time I talked about these matters was the last time, the most selling job mission I went on, out there selling markup. One of my, you know, I sort of gate door to door, knocking on doors and saying, would you like some markup for your Greek inscriptions? Was in Berlin, because that's where they've got a lot. It wasn't quite like this. But this gives you the kind of tone. And there was something that we had in common. You'll be glad to hear. Because I noticed that when Obama arrived in Berlin, he picked up a theme which I imagine he got from me, but which actually it's impossible to avoid when you're in Berlin, because it's impossible not to think about borders. It's impossible not to think about Grenze. You're at a place where borders have changed, where borders have moved, and where borders are being crossed. And one of the things I find myself thinking when I was trying to sell markup to people is that you mark up texts in order to cross borders. You mark up texts every time you want to extend from the individual, from the congregation, from the monastic community, who all can recognize the quotations so they don't need numbers, out into a wider and less predictable world. You don't know who your audience is. You can no longer make assumptions about what they know. And shared protocols of marking up your text, humble and boring as they may be, and lots of typing though they may involve, are actually very important prerequisites to communication without borders, or perhaps more safely, across borders. There's another great place where people have given great lectures. Just some examples of borders. Here we all love the obelisk, and we remember that it was put up with great difficulty by the city prefect Proclus. And on the base of the obelisk are two epigrams. honouring Proclus for the work that he did. And because this is Constantinople still in the 4th century, on one side the epigram is in Latin, and on the other side it's in Greek. The way that we use texts and the way that we present texts means that texts like that, which are integrally linked to one another, are as likely as not to get separated from one another. And one is likely to go and get put in a collection of Latin verse, and the other is likely to get put in a collection of Greek verse. One of the borders that we are constantly needing to deal with is the simple language border. And consider Etienne with his bilingual text, using verses to make sure that the Greek and the Latin could stay on the page and that you could relate the two to one another. So one of the barriers that we deal with in classics and that we need to be overcoming is the language barrier. And certainly, consistent schemata of markup give us the possibility to present material that is in different languages while linking together those aspects which are shared in both by using markup which is consistent for the two languages. The other problem that these inscriptions have is that they are verse, not, we note, poetry. We know they're not poetry because they're not written on manuscript, on vellum. If they were on vellum, they might be poetry, but if they're on stone, they must be verse. There's a constant kind of aesthetic distinction that goes on. But at the same time, verse is terribly irritating to people who like nice, sober prose documents. Because, of course, verse is often extremely unhelpful in actually giving you all that boreal data that you're in search of. This is one of my favourite borders to cross. You will all recognise well, it's very appropriate to be thinking about the Colossus of Memnon. The Colossus of Memnon was an Egyptian statue. One of these two statues was cracked by frost, they seem to believe that's what caused the frost was, the crack was. And for a long period during antiquity, when it heated up in the morning, when the sun rose, it sang. It produced a sound. And this was a great wonder which every tourist went to see, including our good friend and close neighbour, the Emperor Hadrian, about whom we know more than we want to at the moment. But we're not, I suspect, I haven't been to the exhibition yet, so I don't know, they may have covered this point. Hadrian turned up with, there you see, the perfect guide. Hadrian turned up with 126 people in his retinue. Well, I mean, he must have had more than that in his retinue. But 126 people clambered all over that statue and wrote poems on it. I don't think they actually clambered. I think as they were gentry, I think they stood there. I mean, the actual logistics of this are really quite interesting to think about. You've got 126 members of the royal court, each of which have written a clever epigram. They turn up, there's this enormous statue, and they've all got to have their epigram inscribed on that statue. And the whole enterprise of how it must have happened, which is quite interesting to think about. I think that collection of verse is a really interesting cultural phenomenon. You don't find those verses drawn into the discussion of the literary culture of the second century. They don't belong because they are in the wrong format, they're recorded in the wrong kind of way. They sit on the shelf in the library called epigraphy, which is a very, very long way from the shelf in the library called literature. We don't have appropriate mechanisms for drawing this kind of material together. Oh, that's back, we should go. So here is the object which is on the poster. This is an inscription from Aphrodisias. We finally got to Aphrodisias. As you can see, a rather cheapskate piece of work. They've taken an architecture, I think an old statue base, and sort of sliced the side down and used it as a surface on which to inscribe. And you will see, which is quite important, that little line between the verses. We know that a very great deal of verse was inscribed. We have the verse that we find inscribed, like the poems on the Colossus of Memnon. We also have the many, many volumes of the Greek anthology. And the Greek anthology is made up of epigrams, and of course the original meaning of the term epigram is that it's something written on something. An epigram is, in its essence, intended for inscription. It's just that as the centuries roll past, people also write epigrams in the form of the short, effective little verse, which don't actually get inscribed on anything. Just as not all lyrics are sung, that's the kind of thing that happens to literary forms. So the Greek anthology, which we have, contains, as you know, it's a very complicated document, a very complicated manuscript tradition, and it contains within it collections of poems, and some of the earliest of those collections are from the Hellenistic period. And some of the latest of those collections, some of the latest poems, are almost certainly, are certainly 6th century AD. So you have a collection of poems which were collected over many centuries and which have been organized and reorganized during those centuries. So that rather than staying as under their authors or under date, a lot of them were reorganized by category. So you have a whole volume of funerary epigrams. And indeed, that is a very large book of the anthology, and indeed in the inscribed world, what happens is that the largest number of inscribed poems that we have are funerary. And arguably, that focus on a particular genre is yet another reason why people have not been terribly interested in getting engaged with inscribed poems. There's too many all of the same kind. What people have got better at doing over the last century or so is working out that, as well as everything else in the Greek anthology, we do have texts of epigrams that were inscribed, as well as texts of epigrams that weren't inscribed, all jumbled up together. And sometimes it's said there's a little lemma which tells you where the text was. Now, the stone that you've just seen has two epigrams on it. And the first one, they both honour the same man, who is, it would seem that he's no longer alive, but it's not clear that these are actually from his tomb. They are two separate poems, and their separateness is such that this one, Now, heaven knows what made that happen. This second poem is in the Greek anthology, and the first one isn't. Now, it used to be the view that inscribed poems in the Greek anthology were collected by early epigraphers with notebooks. In some cases that may be the case, but I actually think that it's far more likely that when you've gone to the bother of writing an epigram, you actually circulate it in literary form among your friends as well as sending it off to get inscribed. And that might explain the rather substantial textual variant between the anthology text of this poem and the inscribed text. Xenon, the nearby structure is what makes sense in the inscription, but it turns into a hollow structure in the anthology where it's a kind of freestanding poem. Now, what I find most interesting of all about this is that, therefore, what you're looking at here is a poem here which is literature and a poem which is not. And I know that this is literature, as I always say, because this is in the TLG, and that's not. This stone just manages to make the statement that you cannot rationally separate inscribed poetry from uninscribed poetry. And you must break these barriers down. It's not sensible to be writing about the poetry of the Roman period, and I say that advisedly, without taking this other poetry into account. Interestingly, there has been work on early inscribed epigrams. There's always a lot to be said for being early. You get much more respect. And so people have been prepared to go out and collect early inscribed epigrams and bring them into consideration alongside the literary canon. As things get later, they're less and less comfortable with doing so. We do have the funerary epigram for the same man, Asclepiodotos, and it's that monument that I showed you at the beginning. It's fragmentary, and as usual, it doesn't tell you very much. Notice how we've presented it there. We've decided to use the layout of an epigram rather than the layout on the stone. Normally, when we present inscriptions, we present them with the layout on the stone. The interesting thing about marking the material up is that you can mark it up with both. And your markup will then allow you to present it the way the epigraphers want to see it, rippling down the stone, or to present it the way that people interested in literature want to see it, following the flow of the verse. We had long discussions as to which format we should use when we actually put the material online. And there isn't a right answer. The nice thing is that once your material is up there in XML, there is no longer any excuse for the person who is preparing a corpus of Greek verse of the Roman period, not to download the XML, already carefully worked out and done for them. I mean, all the markup's been done for them. And to present those texts with the other texts. I think one of the interesting things about these new forms of presentation is the possibility of presenting material in a way that doesn't frighten people. Presenting material in lots of different formats and choosing the format that is appropriate to the audience that you're dealing with. So if the audience that you're dealing with is made up of timid philologists, you can make them feel safe by laying it out in verse lines rather than laying it out, whereas the epigraphers might get very, very uptight if you did that. And as you can see, the conventional compromise system is actually not very, that is not very nice. It gives you all the data. It gives you both kinds of data, but in some ways, it's not nice for anyone. It's not nice for the epigrapher, and it's not nice for the philologist. The nice thing about an XML output is that you could offer both forms. It does seem to me that the most interesting thing about what we're doing at the moment, putting stuff online, is not what we're doing with it, but what people are going to do with it. And how long that's going to take, one doesn't know. But what you hope to find is that people have taken a selection of these inscriptions and repurposed them for a PhD thesis or whatever else, put them in a different kind of context, used them in their own kind of work, and crossed a few more borders. And that's why one of the borders that I think it would be really valuable to cross is this border between inscribed and literary verse. I'm very interested in the uses of verse for all sorts of other reasons. I'm interested in why, in the late imperial period, from the 4th century onward, people start putting into verse texts of a kind which they had previously been putting into prose. You start getting honorific verse from the 4th century onwards in contexts where you'd not had it before. It seems to me that there is a great deal to investigate there, because it seems to me to raise questions as to what people thought it signified to put a text into verse. None of us have difficulty with epitaphs being in verse. In all cultures, that seems it's because so easy to be vague in verse, which is useful in epitaphs. But it's in fact very irritating when people honour the governor of the province in verse, because they're equally vague. And what you'd like to know is what his last job was and who his father was and all those sorts of things, the way a nice cursus honorum tells you. And instead, all you get some stuff is about how he was great, which is nice to know, but not really very helpful. But it's the move into verse in this period seems to me to raise hugely interesting questions as to what is verse for? What do you perceive it as being? What do you perceive it as adding to a text? What makes it a mark of honour to be honoured in verse rather than in prose? But before you can ask all those kind of questions, you need to be able to bring lots and lots of data together that is being presented in all kinds of different ways. And so what I very much hope for our markup is that what it's going to do is break down a lot of, I think that's our symbol image, that it's going to open stuff up, that it's going to make discussion easier, that it's going to get taken away and used in ways that none of us have thought of yet. And that's why I think markup is really extremely exciting. And the verse example is just the example that's closest to my heart.
Interesting talk. I'd like to open it up now to questions.
Have you reminded people they're being recorded? Give them that careful warning.
That's a very good point. Yes, you'll have noticed some microphones dotted around the room. If there's anything you're not happy about being broadcast, please don't say it. as we don't really want to have to go through and edit. Edit little pieces out from there unless it's absolutely necessary. Barbara, please don't feel too afraid to ask questions at this point.
Do you think markup will solve most of the problems, such as, for displaying or presenting ancient texts, such as the annotation, for instance, the last...
pulling all those...
The last image.
Yes, yes.
The annotation, which is really an extension scholarship for that particular context on the page, and presenting it within the context digitally. Is it, to achieve the same aim of the ancient writer?
I think it ought to make it... Why is it so exciting? I think it ought to make it much easier to present those layers of information. One of the things that I can't work out in my own mind is the other aspect of publishing online is... If I can stop this jumping about, we can see him... is having all these images, is having so many images. One possibility is that we'll end up with texts like Huan's, where you actually take the image of the document itself and mark that up. I was very, very struck by your dividing each of the words up. I thought that was just, that would just take forever. That's the only problem. But one possibility, if you were presenting the text of that Langton thing, it's an astonishingly complicated thing, isn't it? What role would you give to the actual image of the page in trying to get across to people what was actually there? But I suspect one could use markup very, very effectively to create or to mark up all those different hands who are clearly working on that page. Where's he gone? Where's Langton gone? Oh, I had him on my knees here.
Because some of the Arabic, for instance,
yes,
manuscripts, and this annotation, we call it verification.
Yes, yes.
Which basically verify the text written there. By referring or citing other
yes,
people who refer to. So it's quite a complex issue.
Yes.
And it would be fantastically in a markup to produce that, obviously.
Well, of course, one of the tantalising things is that just at this moment, I think one of the things that's tantalised us a lot is that one of the things that online publication gives you is wonderful opportunities for cross-reference. But you can only cross-reference to the stuff that other people have got around to putting up online. So there are all kinds of cross-references we would like to make to things that aren't online yet. So what you really need is huge bodies of material so that you could actually create that kind of interaction. And it's tantalising in a way. One of the things, it's very tantalising that the TLG is kind of locked up behind money because you can't, there's obviously a lot of cross-refer. It's also difficult to cross-refer within the TLG. But, for example, the Packard Humanities Index, the Packard Humanities Institute collection of Greek inscriptions, which is now available online, recently, about a year ago, introduced an individual number for each text. So you can now refer directly to that text and take the reader there. Now, when we were doing the commentaries for the Inscriptions of Aphrodisias, that wasn't yet the case. And I would love in a later edition to be able to go through and make each of those a live link. Because it's all very well somebody saying this term is also found in the following three inscriptions, but it does assume that you're sitting in this wonderful library with all these wonderful books all around you. And if the stuff's online, it would be wonderful to be able to cross-refer to it. And so it would be very interesting. It would facilitate the exploring of how these manuscripts were used and developed and what any one of these scribes had available to them.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Yes.
And which is going to go live at the end of October. And the idea there is that people will be able to click on the image and they will be able to go to the transcription.
And so that's what you can do in Sinaiticus, isn't it, Juan? Yeah.
So I imagine it's a similar protocol.
Yes.
So you're something similar in your case?
All we've got is much, much more primitive. This is much more like a printed book representation. We didn't have the money. But also, it's the enormous number of images. If you've got 1,500 inscriptions, and many of those have got 3 or 4 photographs, and they're all different too, rather than just working your way through a manuscript, which at least you can kind of systematize the operation. It would be desirable, but on the other hand, I think you could say, I mean, I think the other thing we all have to watch for all the time is overkill. The fact that you can do something doesn't necessarily mean that you need to. And we've got so many images, actually, that's not one of the best ones. Colour is so often not. But we've got so many images of this text. We can offer people a lot of photographs. The readings are pretty simple. So I think it'd be nice but not essential for us to do that. But directly you go back to something like this, then this kind of complexity, then I think precisely the technologies that are being worked out for the Palimpsest and the Codex might be much more relevant. I mean, just you've got all this interlinear stuff as well. And each of these additional texts you want, presumably, to be able to read as a nice, clean piece of text. And you also want to be able to relate it to its place on the page. Oh, a difficult question. I'll stay with water. Actually, I'll have white. Nobody's going to go racing out and write a corpus of Roman verse. I don't understand it. I thought people would be queuing around the block.
If you text like in the lines as well, is that
Yes. Decorate?
What is that in relation to?
I believe I shall have to look at what the people who did this tell me. I think it's just further commentary, not translation. Some texts have translations written into the manuscript. I was looking, one of the images that I looked at, which I thought was interesting, was a... when I was sort of looking at the different ways the books were laid out, I was thinking about this, which is a book of commentary. And I thought, that's interesting, because, again, you'd think once you were writing commentaries, you would start wanting numbers. I mean, it's astonishing, not... I mean, I suppose the plus about commentaries is as long as it follows, you've got the original there, you've got your commentary book there, and they follow in the same order. But still, numbers were so useful. I find that all quite strange.
And this image you are showing to us in this manuscript, have they already been transcribed?
This particular one?
Yeah.
I think so. I believe it's quite well known. I mean, but there's an endless... I mean, obviously, anybody who wants research for the rest of their lives works on manuscripts, because there is absolutely no limit to how much there is to be done. This project, they seem just to have photographs. I was looking around online for photographs that illustrated various kinds of things. And I found this really rather nice exhibition in, I was going to say the back of the Beyond, but somewhere in America. Where is it? Southern Methodist University. And they've clearly got some very important material. And this was just an exhibition that they had. And here, you see, is there's a description at some point here of what it is they've got, of what all those different texts are. That's right, it's rather difficult to download. They won't let you download it because you're actually supposed to buy the CD-ROM, I think. But that's all the difference. And this is this nice citation about Langton adding chapters, which is really rather pleasing. But of course, the other complication is that these things keep on getting added to. So you've got all these, you may have much later stuff as well.
I think it's the syndication of information, as you said, that the text, I mean, your markup will be allowed to allow people to download it is a fantastic idea, and I hope everybody will take advantage of that, because you're allowing people to use your precious material.
It's really outstanding. But in a way, you want them to use it the same way this has been used. I mean, it's all about using and adding and changing, and not perhaps changing, but modifying, adding value to something, isn't it? A book is a download. How about that? I mean, every book a download. But it's that it works only because we're very strict in ensuring that our XML observes internationally agreed principles. The minute you let that slip, all these possibilities start to dissolve. And you create this beautiful, beautiful thing which nobody else could do anything with. And it's that process of I was thinking, looking at those papyri, I thought it's knowledge breaking out of private ownership. So you really feel those papyri are just for one person to have. Like all those very, very small Bible manuscripts, of which there are a lot, and other manuscripts. Very, very little ones. And of course your book is for you to have, but lots and lots of other people have it too. And therefore its nature is completely different, because we're all sitting around the table, we're all reading the same book.
I think that struck me that it seems to be the very earliest text you've got a really record or consolidated, as we heard last week, of one place, these things are consolidated at one point. They're not communications in the sense that I'm writing this so you can read it. Because even that's a change that comes in. Obviously, it comes in a bit strongly with the printed version, but even
before. Well, that's before, where this manuscript is. But again, that's why I did mention the aspect of reading aloud. That as long as books are very, very expensive, the best and most efficient way to communicate the information is actually to read it aloud. And of course, if you're
read aloud to a group of persons.
Yes. So and also to yourself, but teaching, because of course, if you're reading a text aloud, and it's marked up in chapters and verses, you don't say verse 1, verse 2, verse 3. It'd be incredibly irritating. So reading aloud, if what your text is a thing for reading aloud, actually what you want of it is sort of different. And basically, as long as you have something to indicate to you roughly where you're supposed to be, whence the rise of the lectionaries, it is fulfilling a really valuable purpose. But you don't need the kind of way in which you communicate is different. That's why I gave you Beatus Vir. I like the idea of a culture where actually the way you... Well, we all do that a bit, that we identify things Well, we identify, yes, we identify books by their titles. And we use those titles in quite a informal, friendly kind of way, don't we? Have you got a copy of Persuasion, you might say? I mean, that sort of thing. I thought, we're going to start with Beata's View. Not, we're going to start with number one. And you can, it's quite easy to imagine a culture, particularly for the more poetic works, where that works as a way of cross-reference. But I do wonder how people find their way about in the Book of Kings 2 or something like that. I mean, perhaps you just do it by story. Let's read the bit about David and Bathsheba, and we all know the story, so you can all find it.
I think the chap Stephan has put two versions of the Bible in different languages because presumably there's a confluence of scale from the printing point of view.
And also it's what people are interested in at the time. It's the great moment of, it's the surge of Protestantism and all of that. But yes, it must be much better and to have it all in one. And interestingly, at just the same moment, the first big Hebrew Bibles are being printed, and they adopt a similar, they gradually take over the same, adopt the same numbering system, all in the same circle. It all seems to happen largely in Switzerland in the 1540s, 1550s, 1560s. It all seems settled. By 1560 is the first English Bible with verse numbers in it. So it's terribly quick when you think that 1551 is when the first editions come up.
Presumably, presumably, the people who are actually going to be able to read these and the people who are going to be using them were people who know the Bible pretty much back to front anyway. So, I mean, ordinary people wouldn't actually be reading the Bible.
That's why the problem is created by students. Mm-hmm. Are students ordinary people? the creation of the evolution of the university means that you're no longer just dealing with monastic community. You do really know it back to front. The teacher may know it back to front, but all these young people have turned up and are sitting there taking notes who actually don't necessarily know back to front because they're doing it now. They're not. They're not people who've entered the priesthood or entered the monastery, and this is their working, their job, but to learn it all. They're there to listen to the discussion and to follow what's going on. I find that just so interesting. You know, what have universities contributed to civilization? The introduction of chapters and verses, or chapters.
I remember when I was a teenager and we have this next door boy, his father was interested in collecting manuscripts. And we decided to look for a suitable manuscript for teenagers. And the boy, he said, oh, we have a magic spells manuscript. So he brought it up and we agreed to look for a chapter about spells. And we all nearly came to agreement. The other guy, he said, no, we want something about, what's the other chapter? About curses.
Oh, yes.
So you all, more or less, you well-defined
yes.
The books you're actually going through, that divided into chapters, what interests you, what interests mm-hmm. the other. Mm-hmm. So the definition and genre is one pretty universally defined, anyway.
Yes.
Well, I was going to say, yes, what does the difference between prose and verse and an epigram say about you? Can I put in my request now? I would like to write an epigram. Please make one verse.
Yes.
But coming back to the markup and the presentation, yeah, we live very, very firmly and solidly in the culture of a book, and we all understand the rules.
Which have actually evolved very slowly.
And we do for one of my undergraduate classes where we teach the web stuff, we particularly use XHTML rather than HTML, so that we they are forced to do what we call document analysis and give them some documents, and they have to figure out, well, what is A really?
Yes.
What is a paragraph? You know, why
yes.
is it this way? And I use some of your material.
Okay.
And I've got more now to get it to plagiarise now. But material, particularly when it comes to showing them, this has not always been the case. I mean, I start off with a Phycos disk and I work my way up. And the clincher is having lots of foreign students is, you know, the ability to pick up a book in a different language. You may not be able
yes.
to read the language, but you understand this is a chapter, this is a heading, the index, and everything. And along now, I did some research on where we started the markup from the text. So the one that is a clear something that we would or, sorry something that we would more clearly recognise as a printed book because it's divided up in that. I think I've got some of the DRB stuff where it starts to have your capital letter, so it's Anglo-Normans and about 11th, 12th century.
Mm.
And they're starting to put your dots in between the clarifiers and stuff like that. But a lot of it was saying, this is coming back to the reading aloud business, it's there for reading aloud for people who don't know the text by heart. And it's an aid definitely to reading aloud, but also for silent reading, because it allows.
Yes.
Somebody who's never come across that text before to actually sort of make sense and get it in some sort of ordered fashion. Because most of them, you know, were, as you say, you know, even these were, I guess, originally written for all the transmissions, so to be read at samples, to be read at functions, or the same diploma and stuff like that for oral performance. So there wasn't any need for anything like that. So thank you very much for seeing more of your material.
I think the other thing about the oral is that for as long as you're only producing one manuscript at a time, reading it aloud is absolutely essential. The only way, the most efficient way to disseminate the contents of this manuscript is to read it. Because it'll be a lot quicker for 40 people to get the content of this document if I read it aloud than if we make 40 copies. So that it's really deeply in it, the reading aloud aspect. And for us, it is so marginal.
It's part of our culture. And just to reverse engineer the part of punctuation, it's the first time you read something. You need that punctuation to help you make sense out of it when you're reading it aloud.
Absolutely.
You know where to take your breaths and where to make the pauses. And it changes the meaning if you take those in the
yes.
places.
Yeah. Oh yes.
Yeah.
You wanted to ask a late antique question.
I did. I wasn't clear from what you said. Is this what you're now collecting and digitizing?
No, I want somebody else to. No.
Because I was wondering, you know, how you were going to, how where they had come from or how you were going to collect them.
No, as usual, it's a job for somebody else that you will recognise my
advertising for someone else.
I think it's a kind of mission that I've had for a long time to try and get people to notice that this stuff is there. They're pretty unhappy when they find it, and they're very unhappy when they find it in epigraphic publications, which is why possibly the answer is, you know, to have a nice, easy version that you press into the hands of philologists with all the square brackets taken away or something like that. The transforming thing that has happened in the study of inscribed verse for this period is actually, I'm afraid, the publication of some books, because there was great enterprise during the 80s to collect inscribed verse from the Roman Greek world, and they're in that blue Cologne series, and they are a very useful series of volumes, but it's really disappointing how little response there's been to them. You know, they just sit there and everybody says, isn't that a good thing they've been published? But you don't see people racing around trying to pull them together. And I think there's just a kind of real problem about who the people are who go and look at the epigraphy shelf as opposed to the people who go and look at the literature shelf. And they've just been told that those are for different people. And they hope that they are. And also, if you're in the literary world, I think you're hoping, you think, well, I've actually got quite enough, thank you, I don't really need any more, all this other stuff. But the interesting thing in the verse world is the enormous political success of papyri, because you're allowed for literature on papyrus. You're not allowed for literature on stone. And I think that's just because it happened that at an early stage the papyrologists found some texts which they knew to be literate, you know, bits of Homer on papyrus, and that raised the status of papyri from that moment. And so therefore it was acceptable for literature to turn up in the papyri, and of course loads of it has. But people aren't going round publishing, you know, the lost poet of... there are a few inscriptions, I have to say, there are just a few of them have made their way through. But on the whole, we haven't seen people discovering wonderful poets. There's a nice man at Aphrodisias who wrote a poem and puts his name in the last line. He says, this was written by Pythionos of Tralles. So, I mean, there's a monograph there. Immediately, somebody's write on Pythionos of Tralles, you'd think. Determining his verse style, you know, recognising it all over the place.
Well, I think
that's
something, yeah.
Yes, verse.
Yes, verse. The thing with verse inscriptions is that they have been sitting somewhere in between. And that is a big problem, that's why they have been neglected. So if you've got verse, don't look at that. Otherwise, they get scared about them, but somehow they don't consider them
serious. They're not really serious, I think, is what the people think. It's a bit frivolous.
Well, yeah. While philology,
oh, absolutely.
You have to start because it's not real poetry.
Yeah.
Interested in. When I decided to work on verse inscriptions, I was very naive because I didn't know verse inscriptions. But probably I was quite privileged because I didn't consider myself an epigrapher and I didn't consider myself an epigrapher either. And now that I have been looking at verse inscriptions for a while, I can see that they can interesting example of a bipolar problem, but they don't need to be divided necessarily into two parts.
Mm.
And they can definitely be studied from two points of view. And what it is difficult to put this idea
You can have different doorways then for different people to walk through,
yes.
Can't you?
Yes.
You can have a sort of track for the philologist to follow, or the historian, or the epigrapher, and they can all be made comfortable with the material.
Yes, because even other scholars can have been approaching those descriptions for years, and they produce books. They still seem to follow their own path,
yeah.
Forgetting,
yeah.
That these are descriptions.
Exactly.
So one way or the other, the works are not complete. So if we can put them online,
so there you are. That's the core. It is coming. You see,
well,
it is going to be done. That's Valentina's next project.
It's great. I mean, it's just one way of crossing the bridge.
One of the things that I think is utterly interesting about the move to verse in the 4th century. For categories of texts that have not been in verse, is that it happens in both Greek and Latin at the same time. And it's always interesting when that happens.
Of course, I'm going to say it's because they built bigger tombs and you could write better, because that one you showed us, I mean, the chap had a crammed whole damn thing in, and he certainly couldn't have, so to, and then one line you'd see the thing that made the rhyme work.
Yes, 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 well, there must be more beneath that we haven't got anymore. But that would be, but these people are pretty humble provincial people. Those are not big tombs.
I think we will continue the discussion now more informally. Could I just ask everyone to thank Charlotte once again?